You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the battle bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the battle bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the battle bridge.
Welcome, welcome. You are listening to the Battle Bridge on the Trekmate Family Network. It's crisp and clean and no caffeine. Ha 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 ha. 7-Up. Buy some today.
You're listening to the Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything that is Star Trek: The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Code of Honor. I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And the episode synopsis this week is: a mission of mercy is jeopardized when a planetary ruler decides he wants an Enterprise officer as his wife. The original air date was October the 12th, 1987. This is the fourth episode of Season 1, and it is written by Catherine Powers and Michael Parron. It was directed by Russ Mayberry, who I believe was sacked halfway through the directing of this episode, and it was finished off by Les Landau. Oh. The episode's guest stars Jesse Lawrence Ferguson as Lutan, Carol Selmore as Yalirina, James Lewis Watkins as Hagon, co-starring Michael Ryder as the Transporter Chief. So, what did we think about this episode? Now, I'm pretty sure that I'm getting a bit of a reputation as an apologist for TNG, certainly during the early seasons. But in my opinion, this episode is terrible. What did you think about it, Lou?
Yeah, I don't like it either. Somewhat. Okay, and we'll get further into the show. But first, as we said last time, we believe our feedback is important for our people to let them know that we are looking, we are watching and listening, and we are doing what you say. So we're going to do a little feedback. Now, this is a late entry, Encounter at Farpoint Part 1, and this came from Jason. A little bit late, but we're going to put it in. It said, "Hey guys, really enjoyed the inaugural episode of TBB. Really enjoyed it," in all capitals. He was screaming. "Already listened to it 3 times. I can't wait to see how it matures for you both. I think the combination of Lou and new guy James..." Jim, I hope you don't mind if I call you Jim. Oh, he doesn't mind if you call him Jim, but he prefer it not. But if you have a good, damn it, Jim, I'm sure he'll like that. Anyway, a combination of Lou and the new guy James are great. Seems like good chemistry already. I think it's good to hear how you reviewed TNG's Escape to Farpoint, even in retrospect. Escape to Farpoint. Is that what he considers that? Does that make sense? It kind of doesn't to me. Escape to Farpoint?
Well, hopefully we escaped from Farpoint.
Yeah, that's what we were trying to do, is escape from Farpoint. He says, which I guess is a little harder to achieve, as you know, as to what heights TNG eventually soared in its writing and acting. Agreed. It made me want to watch it over again. Thanks. I really like the way you aren't watching it and commenting as it's playing. It seems more cerebral that way. It makes me think a little harder, just the way I like it. Cheers, Lou and James. Keep up the polished professionalism. It's working for me.
we have polished professionalism?
I didn't know. I did not know that.
Let us know where you found that.
Yes. Show me an example of polished professionalism, because I hear stuttering and chair squeaking.
So, and that's just during the feedback section.
Sure, we haven't even got to the meat of the story yet. So, but thank you, Jason. You are a good guy, and you're right. We thought about, or at least I did. James wasn't in the meeting with myself and my brain at the time, but we actually thought about doing a full commentary of each episode. However, here was the problem. You run into little problems. When we did it once in a while with the Lou Trek show, you run the risk of pissing off CBS, and it's not something I intended to do. And I have not gotten a cease letter. I haven't gotten a go away letter, or you shouldn't have done that letter yet. But if we were to do a commentary on every episode and included the audio each and every time, I got a feeling we would never survive like that. They probably would shut us down quickly. Other than that, I would love to do one. I think it'd be fun for us to watch it and laugh at it as we're going along. So, but I hear that I think Gamma Quadrant had the right idea, and Delta Quadrant is doing the same thing pretty much. So they obviously have the right formula as well. So who was it that said imitation is the sincerest form of flattery? That's why we're doing it this way. So thank you, Jason. Please send us some more. And now on to the show.
Strangely, I think that the idea in its basic form, which is that we need to observe the customs of a different culture to get something that we need, and we won't violate our rules when the stakes are high, is actually fine. From the original series, I think Mirror Mirror and Errand of Mercy are at least two episodes I can think of that have this message at its core. But this is just a complete car crash in terms of the execution, and I think this turns into a complete mess.
You said car crash? I think more like a pile-up, actually. It's a foggy day, and 47 cars pile up on the interstate because none of them knew that there was an accident ahead. So here's my suggestions for this. Let's go ahead and skip the treaty. Let's transport the vaccine, and we'll keep Tasha, Lieutenant Yar. What do you say?
I think that sounds good. Now is a good time. Let me stun you with a wonderfully interesting fact about this episode that no one knows. And that is, this episode was my first episode of Star Trek. This was the first episode I remember seeing. I caught it on the television. It was being rebroadcast. It certainly wasn't anywhere near 87. It was probably later in 90 or 91, something like that, I suspect. But this was the first episode I remember seeing. And in a strange way, this episode got me into Star Trek.
Really?
Now that's spooky, right?
Yes. How did it get you into Star Trek? I would have thought it'd turn you off.
I mean, at the time, I'm kind of like 10, 11 years old. I see this. I see a spaceship. I see the transporter for the first time. I see, all of the kind of like the cool, colorful future that they had. I didn't care about the episode story. I didn't care about the writing. I didn't care about the message that this was putting across. Well, at least I hope I wasn't caring about the message. But it was kind of like bright enough and different enough on the television growing up that I thought, yeah, this looks good. Huh. And, so this got me into it. And a related fact, of course, is that coming into Star Trek at around this time, my very first Star Trek movie was the one released after this, which was Star Trek V. Uh-huh. And again, growing up, I thought that was great.
I don't have a problem with Star Trek V, to be honest. I don't think it's all that bad.
Actually, I don't either, and I'm sure we'll get mail.
Yeah.
But what I think is worth noting is that you do not have to watch, you don't have to watch the best of both worlds, or you don't have to watch, some of the top-notch Star Trek over the years, sitting on the edge of forever or anything, to be kind of brought into the world. I saw this piece of rubbish and I thought, I've got to get me some more of that. Mm-hmm. It's strange, but it is true.
Makes sense. And of course, I do like an ass-kicking woman, and obviously so does Lutan. So here in the last couple episodes, I've talked about women, strong women in strong roles. And so we have the security chief kicking the butt of Lutan's security officer, guard, whatever he is. second one, third one, fourth one, I'm not sure. And Lutan is very impressed about that. However, it does kind of the story does kind of take a turn for the worse for women when they own the land and the men are basically their manservants who try to take their land. Oh, women are good for some things. I can't do his voice. Never mind. That almost sounded like George Takei. Oh, my.
I mean, mentioning George Takei, I think one thing that's astonishing about this episode, I mean, I think there are so many things wrong. You know, I'm sure we're going to mention the kind of the racism thing. We've got a planet full of black people. Yeah. I think that there's a lot of kind of, you know, the woman angle also just seems completely perplexing and out of place. In particular, Tasha is not the same Tasha that we had in the previous two episodes. The strange thing is that, you know, George Takei joined Star Trek in 66, and, you know, he was, you know, Japanese-American, and apparently it was one of the first shows that he went on where he wasn't expected to put on a, you know, comedy accent. Uh-huh. And now we fast forward 21 years, and as far as I can tell, is this the only episode where, you know, the main guest star is expected to put on a ridiculous comedy ethnic accent
I
to
make know.
It sound like a 1940s African tribal leader?
Right.
It's so weird. And the worst thing about it, of course, is that he's the only one doing it.
Yes.
No one else is doing it. And you're thinking, where is this coming from? It's perplexing. It seems that I think that had this been part of the original series, there would have been the same questions in terms of the political correctness that are raised, you know, 21 years later. And it's my understanding that a lot of this, at least, you know, online on the forums and in various places, it gets pinned on the director for being, you know, really not having done this this particularly well. But yeah, this is really all over the place.
You know, it'd be interesting if I could find like a interview with Jesse Lawrence Ferguson to see what he actually would be like in real life, to see if he actually talks like that.
Oh no, no, he doesn't. He's a straight up American.
Really?
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I must have taken some time to learn that accent. Okay, but here we are, third episode into the season, or third episode into the series as well, and we have an alien with an ulterior motive. So why doesn't Troy detect this?
The only thing that Troy is good for in this episode is she puts forward the fact that there's a bit of sexual attraction there,
yeah.
And that's really about it. This episode does Troy no favors at all.
Right. And the horse? What's a horse for? Horsey.
So you've lost me with the horse.
Oh, they bring in a horse and present it to Lutan.
Oh, yes. Was it from the Ming Dynasty? 14th century? So, 13th century.
Hmm. Not sure about that. I don't remember that part, but yeah, it was in somewhere China. So what do you think he did with the horse when he went back?
I'd be surprised that he took the horse back. When he beams down, I don't see him beaming down with the horse. He's taken the horse, he's been polite, he's stashed it somewhere to one side, and he's left the horse.
So I think what we're seeing here is Picard's love of horses. Has to be. Here's a horse. He rides a horse on a holodeck episode. Guinan is riding a little kitty horse in one of the movies. I think it's just the beginning of the horse. This series is of the horse.
I think if you were extremely generous, you might suggest this is the first instance of Picard and his like archaeological background coming through. But I don't buy it. But I'm going to retract that, and I refuse to be generous.
His equestrian days are coming back to him. Okay. Is it Picard's toy? Or, you know, did he replicate that or something?
I'd hope he replicated, because they don't need to know that it's the original.
Yeah.
They've never heard of the Dynasty. They don't know what a horse is, I assume. So, you know, really, give them a fake. It's not a...
Yeah, really.
You shouldn't give them a... You know, the real one would be wasted on them. Actually, one thing that actually does come up from this episode, these aliens at least, and I think it's going to be a recurring feature, and it'll either apply to warp drive or, in this case, the transporter, because you don't see them using warp drive. But my question is, how do these people have a transporter? Do you get any impression that these people are technologically advanced enough to have a transporter?
No, I don't. Like I said earlier, let's just take the darn vaccine and leave. Why go through all this?
There's a lot of, you know, I find it strange. You do come across aliens, and they have they have key pieces of technology, and then if you try to dig a little deeper, and even to a certain extent, some people level this at the Klingons. You think, how did they ever get to this stage?
Right.
And I mean, humans had we had warp drive before we had transporters, so these people must have, I assume, broken the warp barrier and solved all their solved all the social problems on their world. But despite that, they're still in this ridiculous tribal state where people settle their arguments by fighting each other with big spikes.
Yeah, big spikes and lots of deadly lights. Touch the light and you die. Okay. Well, back in the cargo bay, the Ligonian delegation is about to depart, and Troy still is only thinking about how sexy Will would look in a with a beard, because she's still not detecting that he's going to do something. Captain, he's about to do something. There's something wrong. And sure enough, what's he do? Lutan abducts Tasha Yar. Film at 11.
I think it's very... I didn't buy his idea that, let me say thanks in the only way that, in your human custom way. Come over here. No, a little closer, Tasha. No, if you could just step between us. Come over. Okay, I've got her now.
Yeah.
Quick, beam us down. Even Tasha should have seen that one come in.
Oh, yeah, of course. But we get red alert. Did you notice...
Actually, you get...
Go ahead.
So what I was going to say is, you get the fastest red alert I've ever seen in my life.
Right.
It goes from, it's almost before Tasha disappears, it's red alert straight away, and there's one running in the background, kind of absolutely immediate cat-like reflexes from the crew.
Right, but I believe that the computer is monitoring every... Wow.
Sorry, apologies.
Housekeeping.
Housekeeping.
I believe it sounds like the computer is monitoring every word that's going on on the ship and looking for keywords. So as soon as he says red alert, it triggers red alert. So if that was the case, can anybody sound red alert? So what if, I don't know, Alexandria? She's on deck 14 in her crew quarters, and she says, "Computer, red alert." Well, would it go off? And Picard is, "Who turned that damn noise on?" Or can anybody? Because obviously the young ensign can find out where Lieutenant Commander Data is. I always thought that where is a location search can only be done by key officers. But it seems like everybody can do a location search, so can anybody call for red alert?
Surely only the captain can call red alert, I would have thought.
Well, Riker can. Riker's done red alert.
Right, yeah, I suppose so. It must be... But then you might suggest that you can only call red alert from the bridge, because that's where the command... is taking place at that point. But then, clearly he's calling red alert from the cargo bay.
Right.
I don't know. I'm always under the impression that there would have to be a big button that someone pressed, security chief or someone. But this red alert turns so quickly.
But here's another thing. There's another episode, and we're going to get into it, that they're talking, and the captain actually taps his comm badge. It says, "Computer, red alert." Yes, it was when everybody started to disappear and remember me.
Okay, I don't remember. I don't remember that instance.
Yep, we'll get to that. Yeah, because Beverly's trying to tell him how everybody's leaving, and they're in the conference room, and they finally decide to let's check Holland Shield integrity, keep a transfer or lock on people, and computer go to red alert, and then she says, if I can have Worf, keep an eye, keep a computer lock on so-and-so, and he's, I'm sorry, who? Worf, head of security, the guy who never smiles, the Klingon. So they're obviously the computer can initiate red alert when told to do so. So then it becomes, well, he just yells it in the air, red alert, and there it goes, versus tapping his comm badge or having somebody press a button. Obviously the computer is hip and is ready to go at a moment's notice. So
Yeah, looks like it.
Okay. Let's see here. What did I have before? Why does Beverly bring Wesley on the turbo lift? I mean, he's hiding in the corner of the turbo lift if she's going in to report to the captain.
The thing that this reminded me of, which is, and I'm going to put it out there, from the greatest Star Trek film, which is, of course, Wrath of Khan, when I saw Wesley in the turbo lift, I couldn't help but think he's blocking the turbo lift. Someone is sitting on, deck 5 or so, trying to get up to the bridge, and he's waiting in the turbo lift. And it then put me back to the scene in Wrath of Khan where Sarvik and Kirk stop in the turbo lift.
Yes.
And then they have a chat about it, and they carry on. And he even explicitly mentions the hair, and then they get down to their to the deck they're supposed to be at, and McCoy's there. And
right.
Like, who's been holding up the damn lift? And then Savick wanders off and said, she changed her hair.
Didn't notice. Okay. Well, anyway, we gotta come back. We better hurry up. The Ligonians, they should do like their drumsticks. But not one drum in sight. Do you notice that?
Yeah. No.
Okay. I'll stop that now. So it's now time to grovel for the return of Lieutenant Yar. So why doesn't Picard hit Luton with a few of these and thous and most powerful ones? You'd think maybe that would help?
I think so. I think that what they end up doing, by the way, I am very suspicious of from a production point of view. Everyone comes to Picard and they say, you have to be very patient. You have to let things take their time. I think that's just padding the script at this point.
Okay, let's get serious about something, though. I have to ask this question. Obviously, the planet doesn't have shields. They could just beam Yar. She's got her communicator. Just beam her up. But they don't, because they want the vaccine. The problem is, how do they know that Luton's not down gang-raping her while they're trying to be subtle and gentle with asking and pleading for her return?
Code of honor, right? One of the code of honor says no gang rape.
It might. We don't know. Well, I guess they probably do. Data does know their codes, and knows what's expected or what they have to do now. That makes sense. Okay. So the groveling's done, but Luton can't part with her. He wants her for his first one. But of course, his current woman has an issue with this, so she wants a cat fight. Meow. But Picard
and the first, the first such in 200 years or something. She challenges the right of supersedence.
Yes,
the first time in 200 years, which is astonishing. I mean, why would they have all of this stuff hanging around and everyone being being ready to fight if it's not happened in 200 years.
Right.
I think people would get relatively not used to the fights if they happen once every 200 years.
Okay. But Picard says, no, we're not going to do this, and that's when you get the signature, no treaty, no vaccine, and no Lieutenant Yaw. Now, have you ever been in a meeting at work and you wanted to get a point across, and somebody wasn't going to give you your way, and you said, well, then no vaccine, no treaty, and no Lieutenant Yaw.
Do you know, I'm going to try it.
I think I'm going to try it. We'll report back on a future episode of whether that works, guys.
I think this is the one piece of quotable dialogue from this episode.
Yes.
Is that. But I suspect it's the accent and the just absolute ludicrous setup that makes that hang around in, right. in Trek lore.
Utter nonsense. So Troy tricked Yar. Well, how could she? Wait, how did she trick Yar? Did she get her to admit an attraction? With who? Lutan? I mean, she does say, I'm attracted to him, and I couldn't help but wonder why.
This is one of the biggest problems that I have with this episode. And by the way, just to make things clear, I think this isn't just a bad episode because it's a whole planet full of black people that are acting like stereotypes from the 40s. I think even if everyone was white and they were acting normally, it's still a bad episode.
Yeah.
I think the worst thing is this exchange with Yar, because Yar's come up, Yar is an interesting character at this point. She's a strong woman. She's grown up on a very hostile colony. She's mentioned that, she was escaping the rape gangs and so on. You know where she's coming from. She's not the type of person at this point that becomes, she becomes remarkably happy that Lutan is trying to force himself onto her through just declaring her to be his first. She's not that character. She, in this scenario, she should be as angry as she was in Encounter at Farpoint during the trial. She shouldn't be sitting there saying, oh yes, it was nice to have him, it was nice for him to think of me that way. That's not Yar at all.
No, it wouldn't be.
And she should be up and, she should be up and, kicking this guy and fighting for all she's worth. And I think that's really one of the biggest problems I have with this episode is how they basically turn Yar into a little girl who's really really happy that someone's noticed her, because that's just nonsense.
It is. I agree there. And they mentioned the Prime Directive. Where would this episode in any way have the Prime Directive? I mean, obviously, they're not they may or may not be a pre-warp civilization, but they've already made contact with them. Isn't the Prime Directive not to interfere in the natural evolution of their world?
I mean, that is true. And I think it comes up a couple of times in early TNG where they just mention the Prime Directive and everyone nods as if everyone's aware of fully what that means. And my understanding, at least, which is you don't screw around with people that are pre-warp. To me, it doesn't look like it applies here, because these people are already in contact. They either accidentally they've been brought into the club of the club of the alien races that people can do business with, or they are post-warp, and as such there have been treaty negotiations and whatnot. And when I think is it Troy that mentions the Prime Directive, and then Picard says, yes, the thought has crossed my mind, and I don't even understand what he's suggesting. That if the Prime Directive wasn't there, what would he do? I don't quite get it.
What could he do if it wasn't for the Prime Directive? Get her back? I mean, how? I don't know. This vaccine can't be done anywhere else. Only on Ligonian. Or Ligon, or whatever the name of the planet is.
That doesn't work either. And also, because it's so ridiculous about this, there's only one vaccine, it has to come from this planet, it can't be replicated. Crusher, again, bad scenes with Crusher coming in every now and again saying, oh, it's worse than we first thought, there are millions of them dying. It makes the danger of fading on this mission. It's supposed to make it more relevant, and it's supposed to make it that we take note, but in the end I just write this threat off as being laughable.
Yes.
It's lost connection with reality at this point. Yes. You might as well, there's a billion trillion people that are going to die unless you give them their cheese.
Yeah.
It's just disconnected at this point.
That was good. Sorry. I'll have to pull out that laugh because that was funny.
Sorry.
Give them their cheese. Well, anyway, Picard figures it out, the proper value of women. Mrs. Lutan owns the property, and Mr. Lutan only gets to live in her world. So if Tasha kills her, then he gets to keep it all. Fascinating. So, as Picard says, may your cloak bring you all that you deserve. So, anyway, the Kittley's joke. I thought the Kittley's joke was silly. I mean, there's no way that a computer is going to say, including the Kittley's.
Do you know, I'm going to now shock everyone by saying there's one good thing about this episode. There's a single good thing about this episode. And it's not, you know, the scene between Geordi and Data, which is including the Kittley's, or whatever it is not funny and it's terrible. But it does, it is the first interaction between Data and Geordi.
Yes.
And I like where that goes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, certainly by the time you're talking about Data, sorry, Geordi being chief engineer and how much more they work together and how that relationship develops. I'm, you know, rewatching this and, you know, making sure that going through things in order, I'm sad that this is the genesis of that relationship.
Yeah, it is. But I'll tell you one thing. You said you're kind of an apologist for the early episodes. I am no apologist for Geordi. I have always had a deep love for Geordi. And so you'll see it as it goes on. Geordi is just my man. So, but anyway, I'm going to add some dialogue to the script right now. Okay, so I'm going to tell you what the original script was, and then I'm going to tell you what came after that that probably got in a deleted scene. It says, "Captain, you brought me here to help you. Let me help you." And Picard says, "Then help me, please. What is the way out of this?" To which Troy says, "With the vaccine?" And Picard says, "Yes." And Troy says, "None." Okay, now the deleted scene goes, Picard then says, "Well, that is very helpful, counselor, so why don't you head back to the ship and take a nap already, okay?" "Well, go get some chocolate. You need to recharge your cells or something, you know. Let me help you." "Well, it helped me." "Well, I can't help you." "Well, then why'd you ask to help me?" That's pretty much where I see that one going. So, Wesley, did you notice after Picard lets Wesley on the bridge and go sit at Khan for a while, now Wesley's strolling onto the bridge by himself at will. And speaking of will, he then says, "Oh, you want to go sit at Ops again?" Seriously?
I mean, also, again, this, in addition to all of the other sins of this episode, this is the episode when Wesley starts sitting on the bridge.
Yep.
And thinks that he can hack it. And that's it shouldn't be happening at this point. I mean, I'm an apologist for Wesley. It shouldn't be happening now. There's no reason for it to be happening now.
It is a little too soon. They really don't know Wesley. You know, nobody knows that he's Picard's son. So, but anyway, that's a different story. So combat begins. And the spectators, as it turns out, are just a little bit too close, as we'll find out. And no one bats an eye at the poor fellow who just got poisoned when one of the spikes hits him. You know, he just throws it off. "Here you go. Here's your spike back." And then he looks down and goes, "Oh, no." And he falls over onto somebody's lap. And what do? They just kind of drag him out. No one says, "Hey, guys, you need to get back a little bit or somebody else is going to die." So obviously life isn't all that important on that planet.
No, I mean, imagine, you know, you go to a ball game. A ball goes into the crowd. You try to catch it, you miss it, you then get decapitated and you die.
Right.
There's going to be consequences to that.
There has to be. So I would assume that one of his family members sued the Ligonian delegation for allowing his death to be so close, unless they signed a waiver. I don't know. We'll see. But Yar strikes the death blow and they both beam away. So now, what happens? Picard abducts Lutan. Okay, so maybe Picard wants Lutan for his first one. But anyway, after all, Urena still lives. Witchcraft! You know, witchcraft aside, and she takes a new mate to be her first one. Lutan can be her second one. So unless Tasha wants him, of course. But there would be a complications, is what she says. What complications do you see?
Well, I'm actually surprised that everyone, you know, I'm not a lawyer, by the way. I'm surprised that everyone seems to agree on the legal interpretation of her having died, her having been resurrected, and what implications this has to her marriage, the legal status of her property, and her ability to now, you know, go back into the community and take off from where she finished. Surely there are lawyers that are going to begin earning a huge amount of money by trying to settle this.
Right. Okay. Well, I don't know. Would Lutan live on the ship? You know, and would he, get to live in Tasha's world and sleep in Tasha's land? Oh, Lieutenant Yaw, this is your land. Do I get some of your land? Okay. So in the end, unless you've got something more, I do have the moral of the story.
Is there a moral of the story?
Yes.
There's a part. Sometimes I think about how these episodes should have ended, and sometimes there are things that are, you know, either halfway through the episode or so when you think, well, it could have turned out this way if had this or that happened. When watching this, there's a point where Picard decides to shoot a whole load of photon torpedoes at the planet, and he tells them to target 1 kilometer above the surface. Now, 1 kilometer is 3,000 feet. It's less than 10% of the way of an aeroplane flies. I'm pretty sure that had that been a correct, physical photon torpedo being sent down there, they probably would have wiped out the planet, and then no treaty, no vaccine, and no Lieutenant Yaw, but just a big smoldering planet left.
Yeah, I was going to say, and no people either. Okay, let's see. You know, I'm going to do something. I'm going to make sure of that. Because it seems to me, I thought it was 100 kilometers.
Oh, I thought it was 1.
Okay, I've got it right here. Oh, 1,000 meters short of the planet's surface. Yeah. So he says 1,000 meters short of the planet's surface. That's a little bit higher. That's pretty much close to orbit. Because you're right. I mean, once the explosions come, do parts of photon torpedo fall into the ground?
Next time. No, I mean, 1,000 meters is not high at all. I mean, you're getting pretty close to the world's tallest buildings at that point.
Really? Let's do a Google search. 1,000 meters to, I don't know, what do you want, miles? But a greater power
threatens them both. It's 3,000 feet.
1,000 meters is 3,000 feet? Of deceit and treachery. Oh, you're right. 0.62 miles up. So basically, it's less than 1 mile up from the planet's surface. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's okay. Silly.
So the world's tallest man-made structure is 800 meters. Just over 800 meters. So we're talking about possibly lighting the new year fireworks on top of that building with a photon torpedo.
It's going to get someone's attention. Okay. Well, anyway, I guess the moral of the story is Lutan was wrong. We've got the treaty. We got the vaccine. And we got Lieutenant Yaw. Smoke that one there, Lutan.
Now we'll bring this to a close and we'll rate the episode. So, Lou, what are your closing thoughts?
Like you say, this was a stinker. 1,000 meters isn't far enough to where it's not going to cause some, I don't know, I'd imagine some people's ears were blown out, some windows were rattled. Lieutenant Yaw, she got abducted. We don't quite know what their complete code of honor is, so we don't know what. Obviously, if you think about this also, Lutan isn't completely following the code of honor. Or is that the way they treat their women on that planet to try and take their land? So maybe not all is what it should be. So staying up on the ship while Lieutenant Yaw could be being gang raped on the planet is the best thing to do, I don't think. It's kind of a sad story. So I'm gonna give it a 2.
Oh, okay. I'm surprised. I'm surprised because from my perspective, this is coming in at 1 out of 5. I think it has big problems. it has the big problems with the the plain effort of black people with the funny black tribal leader accent and all the rest of it. But even away from that, it's not even a good, it's well put together piece of racist material. It's very padded. I don't like the it's very padded on the script. I don't particularly like the the story. We kind of are left at the end with despite at the beginning us thinking we have to engage in this culture and respect their ways, and we leave basically sneering at their culture, and we recognize that our culture is superior to their culture, and these people are a bunch of backwards primitives that really we shouldn't be dealing with. And I always felt that when questions like this came up in the original series, we often learned from other cultures. I didn't think that we often left planets thinking, well, that they're a bunch of backwards, nobodies. Let's get out of here.
Right.
And I think that's where we kind of end in this episode. I suppose I'm glad we never go back. I rated it the lowest I can.
Okay. Well, I understand. I'm sure there'll be some ones for me here, but I don't know. I kind of like the cat fight, but that's a different story. Okay.
So join us next week when we will be reviewing The Last Outpost and the first time the Ferengi are going to be coming into Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. And as many of you are aware, Ferengi would be my persona on the Blue Trek Show. So I kind of like the Ferengi, but I like the Quark Ferengi, not this Ferengi, which is played by, isn't Armin Shimerman in this Last Outpost as one of the Ferengi? Hey.
Yes, he is. He is.
So this would be an interesting contrast, and of course you know I'm going to bring that up, the contrast between Quark and whoever he is in The Last Outpost, so that would be interesting. All right, then.
I've been James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. And good night.